Mr. President, can you unite the country?
It's quite a moment, Jake.
Well, I have no problem with reaching out to Republicans. I would prefer to do it that way. But if we hear very early on that Republicans do not want to act in a way that meets the needs of working people in this country or the middle class, sorry, we're going to do it alone. The truth of the matter is that Republicans use budget reconciliation over the years to provide massive tax breaks to the rich to try to repeal the Affordable Care Act. We're going to use it to protect working families.
All right. How's everybody doing today? America, the good guys are back. The Avengers have taken back the White House, and we can all sit down and play Pictionary with Uncle Joe, maybe take a swig later with Auntie Kamala. My name is David Griscom. You're listening to Left Reckoning, and I'm joined today by co-host, good friend and comrade, Matt Leck. How's it going, brother?
It's going well, David. Good to be with you.
What a funny day yesterday. What a day of really feeling like you were invited to a party that you really just didn't want to be at.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Bernie crushing it day one. Talk about a day one agenda. getting in there with the memes. Complete everything about the image to the, like, having to mail something after, you know, you stop by Joe's. All right, Joe, I'll go to your graduation or whatever it is. Clap yes. for you in my mittens.
His recycled mittens.
Yeah. Wonderful. And I'm going to fade out on our music. We're introducing the new music we've had specially commissioned for Left Reckoning here. That was by my pal from Minnesota, Christoph Brun. He's a great musician. I'll have his full plugs when we start. When I get my shit together, I guess, frankly. But I'll put some of his work in a links in the description. But he's made a few themes for us. That one, I mean, he's just an amazing guitar player. Mm-hmm. That's him ripping that. He can do all sorts of different styles, and we had him do that country one for us there. And there'll be a few others we introduced. So thanks, Chris, for that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, the tracks are all good. There's a couple of them that are just like standalone songs too, which I've been jamming to myself.
Yeah. I mean, I'm partial to his acoustic stuff, but we have some rock and stuff. We got all sorts of different, I mean, that's what Left Reckoning is for. You know, mm-hmm. we're throwing all sorts of different looks at you because we're versatile and, you know, that's what we can do.
Hell yeah. Yeah, we're moving around. Well, today we got a lot going on. We're going to start off talking about, you know, what happened yesterday. We sort of have to contractually. But after that, we're going to take a really deep dive with a friend and comrade, teacher of this show and TMBS as well, Milton Alamadi. We're going to talk about the elections in Uganda, the house arrest of Bobi Wine, and the kind of regional fallout from those events, as well as sort of his takes on what's been happening on the United States. So definitely stay tuned for that. We'll also be talking about farmers' new landlords. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about the proper way to show up and support strikers. Some more update on the fight for a union in Amazon. And in the post game, we'll be hanging out, going through that 1776 project, which, boy, it's something else. I really didn't expect it to be as rich, I'll say, as that, as well as some other fun stuff going on.
Are you saying, David, that they didn't really, you know, go with the Adolf Reed critique and sort of elucidate
no,
that?
They definitely did. Honestly, that would be hilarious. That'd be a great way to piss off the libs if Trump actually just hired Adolf Reed to write the 1776 commission.
Yeah, it's weird how that they never go that route. That critique is always kind of deaf to that particular.
No, I mean, it's like this is like a legit like book report style reimagining of American history. It's a real treat, honestly. I thought that those days were behind us in our post-truth post-modern age, but no, mm-hmm. they're coming back strong here. Mm-hmm. But dude, talking about a post-modern event, What are your first reactions to that inauguration yesterday? I mean, it was really amazing to see just the program of it, obviously, with the capital city in complete lockdown, and just the way that the Democrats were trying to spin that story, especially the fact that there were no people on the mall and instead were just a bunch of plastic flags. It very much felt like end times kind of inauguration there.
Well, you could have interpreted it that way. I think the way the CNN political analyst, what's his name, David Chalian, his response, which, I mean, strikes to me as like what somebody who's microdosing LSD would say about the setup here. Let's just play a little bit of this. That ridiculous. I think that should
be. Let's get this. This is a real treat.
Yeah.
There's still some tinkering going on with the inaugural address, but his aides have made really clear it's not like he's trying to ignore or paper over either what happened at the Capitol 2 weeks ago or what we've been through throughout 4 years of the Trump presidency. And the contrast on display tonight was so stark. I mean, those lights that are just shooting out from the Lincoln Memorial along the reflecting pool, it's like almost extensions of Joe Biden's arms embracing America. It was a moment where new president came to town and sort of convened the country in this moment of remembrance, outstretching his arms. And contrast that with that video you just saw of a disgraced president on his way out at his lowest point in his presidency at the very end here by himself. Fighting for.
Yeah, I mean.
So just for people who might not be familiar, they didn't just bring in some guy off the street who was looking exceptionally chipper. That's CNN's political director right there talking about Joe Biden, of all people, in the most fantastical, just post-reality way.
Yeah, I mean, really like. I mean, I do think the microdosing acid thing is the most pertinent because, like, his arms, 800 arms, it doesn't look like that. Objectively, it looks like like a landing strip at night, like with all those lights. But I mean, Joe Biden, Joe Biden's arms reaching out, and really, what it is. It's an invitation to act like babies or to interpret this like you're a child, right? Like, let's believe in bedtime stories. I mean, the YouTube one doesn't have this. Sorry, I got to plug my headphones in because they're
no worries.
Sorry about that, folks. They'll have heard a notification. but yeah, like, that's amazing. Like, that's the lesson. That's the message we need everyone to get right now. Is that Joe Biden is giving you a sort of a light hug with a whole bunch of fixtures around the
Well, I mean, it's something that we've been saying for a really long time. Actually, particularly to people on the left, when we tell them that you need to be strategic, but it's such a reminder of the way that these pundits deal with politics. For half of these pundits, like, politics is just about the way that politicians make you feel, right? I mean, that's why you see Van Jones crying literally every broadcast now that Joe Biden is brought up. But I mean, and that's why they detested Trump so much. Not so much what he did, but the fact that the vile, disgusting empire that we live in was led by a vile, disgusting reflection of that system. Mm-hmm. And they like the kind of pomp and circumstance, the kind of BS symbolism of somebody like Joe Biden, that they actually think that this is legitimate analysis. Especially given what we've seen from Biden throughout his career, how disgusting the Democratic Party was during the primaries against Bernie Sanders, against somebody who was just fighting to get Americans healthcare during a pandemic. It's just amazing how quickly all that dissipates with all of those folks.
Yeah.
And the other pundits, sorry to go on a rant, but like the other half of pundits are just like absolute psychos who are just want to scold people about how like they follow politics more than you. Who do I mean? I mean, it's like the nerds over, at Vox, people like Matthew Iglesias, the folks who have been so fixated these past couple of weeks on defending Biden's walk back of $2,000 checks for people saying like, oh, he always meant 1400. They always meant 1400. Completely ignoring the fact that pretty much every average voter in Georgia who was just getting inundated with those those ads going into that election with literal imagery of $2,000 checks next to Joe Biden's name, you know, completely ignoring all of that and just saying, oh, I get politics more because I'm psycho enough to spend all my time reading about this and following up on it.
Yeah. I mean, running cover. And I mean, that's why that's, I mean, they'll get, you know, Vox and wherever. I mean, it's hard to follow where a lot of these guys are now because they've moved on to their independent things, but they'll all get access to, you know, these people in a Biden administration. Bessner made a good point about a lot of like, he didn't name these people specifically, but we know he's talking about Matt Iglesias and Ezra Klein and like the first round of like bloggers, wonk blog type people. And they're made now and they don't have any kind of special expertise. Like the work they've done is horrendous. Ezra Klein, famous at the Washington Post for getting played by people like Paul Ryan and Kent Conrad about the sincerity of Republicans about deficits and stuff like that. And but just graduating upward because... I mean, I know in Matt Iglesias' case, isn't his dad like a Harvard?
He's a writer.
Right. So,
yeah. Oh no. I mean, it's a complete, I mean, obviously it's all like spectacle and fantasy. But I'm telling y'all, for people who are watching this show or people who haven't had the unfortunate experience of spending much time with a lot of the folks who populate, especially to the Washington DC media, no, these people actually are about as vapid as they appear. This is what they talk about privately as well. They really are enamored. You know, when I used to work in media, my old boss had a big ass picture of Joe Biden eating ice cream. I used to work at a Arabic newspaper publication in the United States, and they just had their screensaver was a big ass picture of Joe Biden eating ice cream. And I always just found it just absolutely. And this is like, you know, 2014, 2015. I always just thought it was absolutely insane. It's like you're a reporter, not from a partisan, outlet at all. And you're just so enamored with just like BS, like the most like low level marketing schemes from somebody like Biden. It's like, oh, well, you know what Americans love is they like sunglasses and ice cream. What if I put those together? And that actually works on like the drooling horde of like DC pundits for the most part. It's
right.
Quite the indictment.
And we should say like educated people, like that, the same type of people who were appealed to by like all the memes about Hillary with her phone, like the multiple phones or whatever that was. Yeah, very bad stuff. But they're in charge now. And I think, I mean, we have an axis of progressivism in North America.
Let me show. This one's amazing to me. So, yeah, you want to talk about dump takes. I mean, this guy is sort of like a low-level reporter. What was it? What's the stupid Democrat blog? I can't remember right now.
Fire Dog Lake or something?
I can't remember. Anyways, this is an exceptional combination of tweets over here. AMLO is probably the first person who's just a random Twitter account has a picture of Joe Biden, Trudeau, and AMLO saying North America finally has the left trifecta, which by the way, what a sad first of all complete fantasy take to even consider the idea that we have some kind of proper left bloc in North America right now. But honestly, compared to like the pink tide, a really pathetic showing. Matthew Chapman right here really adds on to the idiocy of this whole exchange by adding AMLO is probably the weakest of the three in terms of his leftist credentials, but yeah, close enough. And like with that person is again, this is like wanting to be pampered to your feelings. Like, look, there are criticisms of AMLO, and I don't want to get into all of that right in this moment. But honestly, out of the three of them, there's one person at least who is pushing back in the slightest against, Western capital and Western finance, and that's AMLO, right? What Chapman means here by AMLO not being left is not catering to his like personal need to just have somebody on television all the time just saying orange man bad, right? Like that's what they mean by being left. It's like, oh my God, Joe Biden called Donald Trump racist. Like that was what it means to be left. I mean, it's just buffoonery, politics and conceptions of what being left are, and meanwhile, Trudeau don't even need to take too much of a dive into him. Just look at just the outright assault on Native peoples in Canada over the past 2 years in themselves, but throughout his entire tenure as prime minister. Like, these are not left-wing politicians. And it's just, it's pretty funny to fixate on the one from, you know, not in the imperial core.
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, the thing we realize about Democrats already after one day is they love Guaido a lot. Biden's Blinken. Secretary of State. Said that, yeah, we're recognizing Guaido and we're going to push Maduro out. And I mean, I don't know. It's weird to see a guy so fucking weak and then just insistence. Like, this is really what a huge part, like, when people say the Democrats were just mad that Trump was getting in the way of stuff like this, there's a lot of truth to it, because like Elliot Abrams was saying positive things about Biden's policy towards Central and South America. I mean, yeah, it sucks, I guess. Yeah.
No, I mean, it really does. And I just wanted to mention, because I noticed we got a super chat actually on Venezuela and Bolivia that I'll just address because it was a nice gesture. But we don't really do super chats in these main shows. Those are for the Griscom streams and those other streams. So for these, we appreciate super chats to help us keep the YouTube going. But for these, we're not doing like a live question and answer thing. But JT, I appreciate the super chat there. And, you know, they were asking about how we could push back against, you know, Joe Biden coming at Venezuela and Bolivia. And as Matt was saying, it's already clear that Joe Biden has every intention of coming at Venezuela and supporting just the biggest joker at this point in Venezuelan politics, Guaido. And, you know, the answer to that has to be understanding our ability to continue expanding this kind of anti-war bloc in Congress, but also recognizing that the fact is that the socialist left in this country is still exceptionally weak, and we need to expand and build our power and also start putting in those, like, that groundwork of connections between the United States and those other countries, so that when these issues happen, we're not, you know, back, you know, we're not on our back foot trying to push back against the entire weight of empire. It's our responsibility to confront Biden and this, honestly, what it's looking like, a very frightening warmongering group that he's bringing into politics.
Yeah, and I'd say, like, there's squad aligned Democrats like Ro Khanna and, you know, obviously Ilhan, and we're going to have to really pressure them and make, because it was easy under, it was easier under Trump to do this than it's going to be now. And I mean, I think we should expect, I hope we can expect some leadership from those two people particularly on that. But yeah, it's going to be an uphill battle, and they're going to be coming for anybody who does try to stand in the way of that.
I think so. And I think we wanted to say a couple things about, like, the actual politics that we've seen early on in the Biden administration. But before we do that, just in our kind of final reflection stage, just how much of a loser was Donald Trump yesterday? I mean, that was really pathetic. Honestly, you were feeling like that was how he was going to go out, with just like this over the top whimper. And that's essentially what his, like, final speech was. It was a whimper with, like, balloons in it, right? It was amazing that this guy literally was inciting people to take over the government, claiming that the votes were false, which they weren't, right? But claiming this, and then just went out like such a doormat. I mean, just really looked like and exposed himself for what he always was, was just like a whiny man baby with too much money and too much power and people who give him too much spotlight.
Let's share that. I want to play this. This is his final speech, where he goes into post-game press conference mode, like he's like a quarterback, which is like, this is why, how you know he is just the TV president. Like, and you know, the revolution will not be televised, Donald. You should have followed your Gil Scott Heron. But here's
And I can only say this, we have worked hard. We've left it all, as the athletes would say, we've left it all in the field. We don't have to come and say, we'll never say in a month when we're sitting in Florida, we're not going to be looking at each other and saying, you know, if we only worked a little bit harder, you can't work harder. And we had a lot of obstacles, and we went through the obstacles. And we just got 75 million
except
votes.
The final
that's
one.
A record in the history of sitting presidents.
In the history of losers.
It's an all-time record by a lot, by many.
I mean, come on, dude. That's like, that's what your parents say to you
it's
when
the
you
most
were crying in the back seat after losing your YMCA challenge at U7.
It's the most votes a loser ever had, and a lot of people can feel confident about that.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's just so pathetic, and it really is just a reminder. Like, Donald Trump caused exceptional damage, as all presidents do. All presidents cause exceptional damage to people all around this country and all around the world. And Donald Trump is no exception to that. But this, I think, was a very clear reminder of just the lack of follow through in this person. Somebody who just always was looking for a pat on the back. And, you know, just a real pathetic doormat of a person, happy to see him just go out like just such a complete loser that he was, and, you know, very happy to be rid of him. Don't get me wrong. But just that was really, 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 just pathetic to see. I don't have many other words for it. I was waiting for something. I was even waiting for like a little Trumpism at the end, like a little defiance. It wasn't, it was pretty boilerplate. Kind of rationalization from a narcissist.
He never wanted to be president. I mean, I think that was true. He never really wanted it, and he kind of, you know, it's an amazing thing, but it is funny to like, yeah, the QAnon people, they think they want me to do all this stuff, and it's like, I gotta go to Florida, sorry QAnon people, bye bye. And people will want to check out the end of the show tonight, where I have included Vice's compilation of Trump saying bye bye, because it is very satisfying to hear him say bye bye a whole bunch of times.
I think that's about right.
Should we talk about Biden a little bit?
I think so. Biden, you know, came into office yesterday and he put out a slate of executive orders, most of them undoing the devastation and destruction of Donald Trump. Really happy to see, him stopping, not even him stopping, but the Keystone pipeline being stopped. You know, that was the work of serious native and, you know, environmental activists and socialists across the country for a really long time trying to stop that. And that was a great thing to see. Obviously, you know, rejoining the WHO and participating in the fight against the coronavirus is phenomenal. But I don't know. I've been sort of watching this and being a little bit confused by the way that some people on the left, the socialist left, have reacted to this. I mean, this is like basic kind of politics stuff. This is like people, I think that some people are forgetting just how badly Donald Trump managed this crisis. Like Donald Trump really mismanaged this crisis. And if he wasn't such a baby, honestly, about the coronavirus and just try to act like it wasn't a real thing for as long as he did, you know, he probably would have got a lot closer to, you know, staying in office right here. So Joe Biden coming in doing the kind of bare minimum on the coronavirus is good from a human survival standpoint, but it's nothing that is making me sit here and think like, okay, I got it all wrong about this guy. You know, Joe Biden's left. Joe Biden's going to be the next FDR. I don't think we've seen any kind of signals like that.
Yeah, I mean, David Dayen is really good to watch on Biden's executive action. And he has this piece here I'll share on the Day One agenda. And the only thing that from what Dayen wanted to see of executive on Day One that Biden did was the permitting of the Keystone XL. And so, I mean, that applause there. But particularly on, you know, just an example, actually, that's indicative of the limitations here is that, like, for instance, he stopped or continued the student loan policies regarding payments and interest. The authority that he has to do that is the exact same authority that he needs to just cancel, do debt cancellation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like And it should be expected that he does that because it is the right policy, not because he needs to like cover his left flank, I think. And to the extent that he does any of these things, I think it will be because they are the right thing to do, particularly in a pandemic depression,
yes,
more than, you know, Biden, you know, reading the right magazines.
Literally just mimicking other governments. Again, not radical governments, but governments in, you know, in Europe and hell, even South America, that have been just trying to look out for people on the most basic level, something that our, you know, the former president and Congress completely failed to do. But I think that's a great way to put it, is like, you know, there is a question of how far he's willing to go. And I think that's what has sort of irked me about some people who are saying like, oh, we should celebrate these things and claim them as victories of our movement. I think that that is one, really setting the bar low. And two, the kind of larger strategy issues that we're facing is Joe Biden is going to do the bare minimum. And if you start praising him for doing the bare minimum, you're just going to get more of that. Two, the most important thing that this movement that we have can be doing is recognizing two fundamental realities, right? One, that the democratic socialist movement in this country is still fairly small and politically weak, while also understanding that that movement is growing immensely and is getting more and more powerful each day, right? So we both have to deal with the fact that right now our ability to, you know, implement our will isn't as strong as it needs to be for the moment. But also being able to recognize that it's getting stronger every day. So that means that we have to be thinking about, you know, how we are reacting to these like early days of the Biden administration. And to me, the most important thing that we need to be doing, along with fighting for like, you know, these basic protections that people need right now and doing the kind of lobbying and fighting to make sure that the things that they will do get done. We also need to be really making it clear to the average person who does not follow politics closely that there is a world of difference between Joe Biden's Democratic Party and the Democratic Socialist Movement. And the fact that the Joe Biden Democratic Party is not implementing the things that the Democratic Socialists want to put into place is because the Democratic Party has no real desire to fundamentally change the world that we live in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So don't get caught up. And just like the last thing I'll say is this, a lot of people got radicalized towards the end of Obama, became upset with Barack Obama, got invigorated by Bernie Sanders, and now find themselves as socialists. For a lot of people, this is a kind of new moment for them, where they've basically been in like pure opposition, where you have like a far right person in Donald Trump in office. And now you have, again, another devastating neoliberal in Joe Biden in office, that I think that some people who, especially people who socialize in circles where they're surrounded by more liberals and more centrists and folks like that, might not be used to yet sort of sitting out of the party, right? Because there's going to be a lot of stupid memeing of Harris and Biden over the next couple of months. And you're not going to be able to, you know, show up to the party and participate in all that. So don't get swept up in this. Like, you need to be prepared to hold firm and start telling people who thought that we were very much, you know, of a shared mindset on these things, that no, I actually find that the Democratic Party is just as much an enemy to the progress of working people in this country, just as much an enemy to the prospect of peace around the globe, and just as much an enemy to the fight against climate change as I do the Republicans.
Yeah, 100%. I don't have anything to add to that.
Yeah, no, I think we got, I mean, I think at this point, to everybody, I think this is our last, for a little while, pie in the sky, Joe Biden talk for a little while. Well, so we have a couple things we're going to get to before we get to Milton. Some pretty exciting stuff. But just in between, I wanted to do a quick pitch. Thank everybody so much for the support of this project, Left Reckoning. It's been a really amazing first couple of months of it. I mean, it's hard to believe we're even still just on our third official episode. I mean, it's really been an incredible outpouring of support and ideas. And, you know, it's a great community. It's been so great to see the TMBS community really start to thrive in this new outfit. It means a lot to all of us. For folks who aren't already supporting us, know that you get this extra show after this show, the post game. Very soon, we're going to start adding more Patreon bonus content and interviews like that. This first month, we're still very very much in our building stage, but we're going to go back to that kind of two-to-one content for patrons. You get the theory reading group, which is a lot of fun. You get access to the Discord, which is very much humming in live. And, you know, you get to support this work. We want to make sure that as much of our work as possible is out there to the public because, you know, we find this to be really important. We find building this community to be really important. So if you're able to support, we really appreciate it a lot. And we're very close to hitting 700 patrons. I think we were four away before the show started. So if you're on the fence, you know,
yeah, be 700.
Man, yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun to me.
Yeah. Patrons will have sometime next week. I'm going to record a discussion with Stephen Robbins, or otherwise known as Ronald Reagan, immigration attorney out of Washington. And we're going to talk about Trump and then look forward to what Biden actually should be doing. And again, I think it's important to keep the two views of, you know, what he can be doing and what he is doing. And like, you know, where you come down in terms of like where you, what, how you posture yourself in terms of expectations there is, I think, secondary. I think as long as you can delineate what needs to be done and what they are doing, I mean, that's the mission that I'm at least tasking myself in this administration.
I think that's exactly the way to think about it. And you know, I also do Griscom live streams here on YouTube. I think I'll do one on Monday, either at 5 or 6 Eastern. I haven't figured out a date, but I'll be there and I'll try to get those at least every 2 weeks and hopefully start getting to do those at least once a week too. So this is a great time to, you know, subscribe, follow us on Twitter at Left Reckoning. We're pretty much at Left Reckoning, never out there. Anyways, done with the pitch for now. Appreciate everybody. how to set this one up. So who do you think, is the largest farmland holder in the United States?
I'd say Old MacDonald.
You'd be surprised that it is a computer mogul name of Bill Gates, who has now bought so much land in the past few months through his different holding companies that he now owns 242,000 acres across the United States in farm holdings. Which is absolutely incredible. In his home state of Washington, he owns over 16,000 acres. In Arkansas, he owns nearly 48,000 acres. In Louisiana, a whopping 70,000 acres of farmland. And that's only going to increase as we start to see what is the continued fallout, from this coronavirus, you know, disaster, economic disaster. People like Bill Gates, people who have a lot of money, are going to be cashing in as folks get more and more desperate to sell their assets. It's pretty frightening when you realize how many small farmers in this country have been completely bought out over the past few decades. You know, so like large and very large farms produce around like 63% of agricultural products in the United States. But there still are a significant amount of small family farms, so around like 2 million. But much of that farmland over the next two decades is very likely to change hand, and people change hands as the farming population continues to age, right? And that's a real crisis in farming, is that most of these small family farms really are run by older folks. And there isn't really like this young generation of farmers coming into that. So what you're seeing now is these massive corporate buyouts of, you know, small farms. In particular, somebody like Bill Gates, who's not just buying farms for investment opportunity. He's buying farms because he wants to control agriculture in the United States. And I'm not going to go on some wild Alex Jones conspiracy theory about how he's trying to poison people with hormones or anything like that. But what I am going to ask people is, do you want to live in a country where the means by which we produce the food that we eat is held not just by a few rich people, but in particular by one gentleman with a long history, by the way, of just buying out entire industries so that he can pursue his own, you know, ideas, regardless of whether or not they are, you know, proven.
Yeah. I mean, I think that understates it. He's an intellectual property pirate. Like Microsoft was hit with a consent decree by the DOJ saying, hey, stop doing monopoly stuff. And they didn't. But that was, they at least got the attention of regulators in the 90s for antitrust. And they would do things like, I was listening to a Grubstakers episode on this before, and famously Microsoft would have these like merger discussions, but that would just be cover for industrial espionage. So like he's the complete piracy, like that. That's what Microsoft is: piracy with good lawyers to like sort it out who owns what afterwards. And now he gets to decide. Because look, I mean, my mom grew up on a dairy farm, dairy and soybeans near Wapton, North Dakota. And the exact same thing's happening, right? Like they're not going to be able to pass the farm down to a next generation. So ultimately, probably going to get bought up by someone like this. And that's what's happening on every farm around there. And it is horrible. And that this guy, with these profits that were, again, it's not like he was doing the coding. Like Bill Gates is like, the idea that this figure would get to determine agriculture in the United States of America because he got lucky in the 90s and like got on the right team is it's revolting. I mean, it's one of the most disgusting things about capitalism. I mean, and not to mention, you know, the ways he gets to play the playground that the Gates Foundation has turned other countries around the world into. I mean, let's just assume and hope for the best that, you know, he's going to use this power that he's amassed for good. I guess.
It's like, even if his intentions are good, like let's just put that, like, you know, just as a thought experiment, as Sam Harris style, right? Like, even if his intentions are good, the possibility of just utmost disaster from Bill Gates is huge, because as I was, you know, saying earlier, and you can look at this with his philanthropy, where he basically, because he has such a large purse, becomes the sole director of a lot of nonprofits around the United States, around the globe, and gets to essentially dictate, depending on whatever thing, most recent thing that he read in Reader's Digest or whatever the hell he reads, you know, whatever a news article excited him the most as like the new innovative strategy. That's his whole thing. It's like putting in new innovative strategies like micro lending, for example, which has been a complete disaster around the globe for small farmers, just introducing them to the finance system so that they can just be perpetually indebted to financial institutions, right? Like that's something that somebody like Bill Gates likes to push, right? Which has been a disaster for people. Put him in charge of our food system, and we'll be facing the same kind of potential for just serious, serious mismanagement of the land. The second point that I want to make, which I think is much, much more important, honestly, is just the question of democracy, as Matt was hitting on too. It's like, that's the thing that's disgusting about capitalism. This guy did computer work, right? And now he gets to decide agriculture policy in the United States. Like, it's a complete joke. This is not like a rational distribution of resources or power in the society. And like, so the inequality aspects of capitalism, yes, all of these other aspects of, criticism of capitalism are 100% valid. But this is also something that I think often gets overlooked, that it's insane that somebody, because they just have access to such immense amounts of, like large amounts of money, now get to dictate a policy and just have actual material power, not just wealth, not that he never has to worry about money again, or he could buy whatever he wants, blah, blah. No, this guy actually not has influence over your life. He has influence over these huge communities. I mean, we're talking about in Arkansas and Louisiana, the guy has over 50,000 acres in Arkansas. Like, that's not a small landowner. That's somebody who has incredible influence on that entire state. Meanwhile, he's from Washington. Right, this guy has no connection to these people. It's a joke. It's not democratic.
What is it? Cascade Investments.
It's Cascade Investments. It's his sleeper company that does all this kind of stuff. And of course, you know, by the way, this story, which has been in all of the major kind of landholding and farmer publications for the past few days, the actual, like, the facts of the story are just that he bought all this land, because they're still refusing to say what they want to do with it. Right. The thing is, it's not even like Bill Gates came out and said, like, I'm buying a bunch of land and we're going to, you know, do green agriculture, something like that. Everyone's just assuming because he wrote a blog post about, you know, family farmers raising more chickens, right, that he's going to, you know, go back to some kind of old school version of agriculture. Right. He just got his Cascade, was it Cascade Holdings or Cascade Investments, to buy up, you know, significant portions of land. Yeah. Right. And he has all these different acres, and all the land holdings that he has are owned by different companies. They're not all owned by Cascade. Anyways, the point is that this is just another great example of the direct threat, that capitalism has to any semblance of an idea of democracy or mm-hmm. community even.
Right. Yeah. Cause I mean, somebody in the chat points out that the ideal of family farm can be romanticized, but the fact is that it is a decentralization of power. And like, mm-hmm. I think you can make the points, which I have time for, which is like they're an insulation against the natives taking back the land. Obviously all that stuff is true. But this is like capitalism in action, right? Like some guy, I mean, it is unbelievable. Are you there?
Oh man, did I drop out on you?
You dropped out very briefly, but you're back now. Let's see.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
Let me just make sure it wasn't my connection. Okay, I think
it was mine.
Yeah, but yeah, Bill Gates. I mean, it's the very first rabbit hole I ever went down on the internet was mm-hmm. a conspiracy theory about that the global elite were building a giant ark in the Rockies. Because they're expecting a flood, and climate change wasn't like that wasn't operative. This was like the 90s, and whoever wrote this conspiracy wasn't a climate change wasn't concerned about it. But I printed it out and showed it to my teacher, and she looked at me like I'm crazy. But I just want to say, Bill, what are you doing with all that farmland? Because another point we should just say is that farmland is distinct from, say, timber or ranch mm-hmm. land, right? Mm-hmm. And like I've personally come across – Ted Turner owns like Montana basically and like the Badlands. And this is about agriculture. This isn't just about, you know, he wants to have place. Mm-hmm. He's going for a play on this sector. And it is just disgusting. Because what's this guy really offered? What's the great fucking innovation?
We should do something more in depth on Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Sometime in the future. But it's also, it's just like, it's disgusting. And it's amazing how much his like PR campaign essentially at this point has done for his image, that people don't find somebody like this, you know, buying up all the land and, you know, all the agriculture land in the country as something suspicious, right? Because it's like, oh, it's nice, Bill Gates, you know. But you know, if
he partners with Netflix and Vox, he's going to keep us up to date
exactly with their positive stories. I mean, honestly, Bill Gates is like one of like the biggest he is the architect of like one of the biggest psyops for capitalism, mm-hmm. Which is like this fixation. I can't remember the name of his organization right now, but basically just pays journalists like obscene amounts of money to print like uplifting news stories.
Yeah. Right?
To basically try to convince people that, like, you know, this system is really working for a lot of folks, when all you have to do is look out your window to see that it really is not.
Yeah. Steve Pinker's grift.
I think, though, we should juxtapose that with another corporation that people do rightfully understand is very worrying, which is Walmart, who has the Walton Family Foundation, which is a foundation meant to spend, you know, the billions of dollars that the Walton family inherited from their father for their just insanely large corporation. Has been spending insane amounts of money in the Colorado River Basin. Do we have that that store handy?
Oh yeah. Give me 1 second.
Yeah, no worries. But the Walton Family Foundation has been pouring millions of dollars into nonprofit groups that are concerned with the Colorado River, which you absolutely should be. But they have been pushing, basically demand management, programs in the area, which pay farmers to not irrigate their lands, right? All across the basin, which is, yeah, here we go. Yeah, so the Walmart Family Foundation has been pouring millions of dollars into water-focused nonprofits. Around $25 million a year to nonprofits concerned about the Colorado River. It's clear the foundation cares deeply about the river in this time of excruciating drought, and some of its money goes to river restoration or more efficient irrigation. Yet its main interest is promoting demand management. The water marketing scheme seeks to add 500,000 acre feet of water to declining Lake Powell by paying rural farmers to temporarily stop irrigating. Essentially, and the reason that people are critical about this is that what that essentially does is it commodifies water by putting a price on water for folks who are choosing to irrigate their lands instead of receiving that kind of payment, right? It's a kind of early stage of commodification of an actual existing resource. And we're not sitting here necessarily criticizing the idea of doing water demand management in the area. I'm not an expert on the Colorado River Basin. I'm not saying anything like that. The issue here, and what this in these Times piece, what I should also mention is written by Dave Martian, points out is that none of the journalists or the local publications around this who would normally, you know, sniff into this story are looking into it. And that's because Walmart has been giving everybody grants. And all of these boards, even though, Walmart is not controlling these nonprofits because everyone is recognizing that this is where the pipes are flowing or where the money is coming from, are going to be much less likely to blow the whistle on any kind of activities from Walmart. It should also be mentioned that Walmart had pay in the area that I lived in, South Carolina, a huge settlement from a lawsuit because they were polluting, I believe it was the Santee River in South Carolina, with just really horrendous mismanagement by putting fertilizer out in by drainage ditches, which was then going into the river and polluting it. Mm-hmm. Anyways, Walmart is a massive polluter. And also the Walton family is not a group of people who we want to be trying to, again, make these kind of decisions for communities.
Right.
And also it's just something that is a very reasonable thing to wonder why the Walton family right now is so fixated on the Colorado River Basin and the fact that they have now basically bought out the local watchdogs and bought out the local journalists. Should be raising alarm bells in everybody's head.
Yeah, I mean, that's the dystopian element of this, is all the local news and local like watchdog organizations. We're at a point in media where it is all hollowing out, right? Newsrooms mm-hmm. have been hollowing out for decades, and the only jobs in media that are rising are like copywriters for public relations. And so like the one area that gets... And, like ProPublica, for instance, does a lot of great work, but mm-hmm. philanthropy is a very corrupt model and it's not to be trusted. And for this reason, because you have these mass, I mean, like we talked about with Bill Gates, but I mean, the Walton family is, they're not your friend. And mm-hmm. even if they were your friend, like, why should they get to, like, your friends don't get to decide the Colorado River is a commodity now, right? That's not how friends act. If you're going to commodify the Colorado River, you're going to take a democratic decision somehow. And yeah, like they just come in and, I mean, this is how, we talked a little bit previously about how hollowed out local news is mm-hmm. particularly. But I mean, this makes the case that also Politico, I mean, there's a lot of money sloshing around Politico, and then even the New York Times, who ostensibly should be above these sorts of things, obviously not, because they're not. They talk about water issues as the In These Times piece points out, without mentioning what the Waltons are doing on the Colorado River for 41 million people.
And I think so too. And just I'm just going to go back to this piece really quick. To make a couple quick points is that one, people are raising the alarm bells that, since the Walton family is essentially buying all these organizations, it means that no one is really going to challenge the strategies that are put forward by Walmart, right? So that's one kind of, nice criticism that like, oh, maybe they're wrong, just like what we were saying about Bill Gates. But I'll read this right now. You don't have to put it up. I can just read it. this is something that is exceptionally worrying, that from this In These Times piece that says in May 2020, the two nonprofits, where the Walton family had put a lot of money into, the two nonprofits collaborated in a story exploring the investment group Water Asset Management, speculating that it sought to buy and dry agricultural water, leaving behind barren dust bowls. What was not reported that only municipalities can buy and dry under Colorado's already tough water anti-speculation laws. The big omission was that a Walton family funded nonprofit, the Nature Conservancy, had an ongoing demand management study exactly where and when the Water Asset Management group was buying land. And that's the kind of
so cloaking story themselves, just to spell it out, they're cloaking themselves in concern about environmental issues to advantage themselves.
Exactly. And it's just one of those things where it's like, well, I mean, the bigger point is that the local organizations are basically being bought out that people aren't investigating. So from the nonprofits to the local publications, this is again from the piece, Colorado College journalism instructor Corey Hutchins said he was surprised to hear the size of some of the funding, with KUNC and Aspen Journalism each receiving $100,000 apiece for several years. That sounds like a big Colorado water story in itself. You might also worry about self-censorship. Anyways, this is just the way that big capital is moving through philanthropy in the Walton's case, and then also in Bill Gates' case, just like through outright buying, to play major roles in the environmental aspects of our society. And then all, in Bill Gates' case in particular, the agricultural aspects of our society. Completely, you know, in Walmart's case, clandestine, because if you're owning the newspapers, and you're owning the watchdog organizations, you set yourself up in a situation where there's not going to be a lot of folks who have the ability to challenge you. And we just wanted to highlight that, today, because these are the kind of stories that don't always float up to the, you know, the front page. But these are the kind of slow burning stories that can have severe, impacts on society.
Yeah, and I also think just in the context of all this attention, you know, we mentioned the conspiracy theories, but there's a lot of you know, anti-vax stuff going on about Bill Gates. Look at what Bill Gates is putting his money, I think.
And, I think that's a good point.
If you really want to follow this stuff closely.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So I think we're about ready to – oh, actually, before we get to the Milton thing, let's do our trifecta of just bad companies. Just this quick thing on Amazon, to follow up on this, for everybody, if you have that first one ready. Yeah. So again, Amazon workers in Alabama are preparing a union, in their facility, and they are fighting against one of the worst offenders of union busting activities, in Amazon. A company that has hired some of the nastiest anti-union lawyers, has been trying to use every trick in the book to prevent these workers from being able to form a union. And this was, I have to say, one of the goofiest attempts that Amazon has put out, which is a incredibly condescending website. If you just want to click on it, Matt. I just click on the actual site itself for a second, if you don't mind. A website that they're sort of circulating around the workers in this Amazon, sorry, this Alabama warehouse facility, where basically they're doing the classic, oh, if you have to pay dues, then you're actually going to be making less money in your paycheck. Obviously forgetting to mention the fact that if you are in a union, you make significantly more on average than non-union employees because you have people who are out there advocating for you. So don't pay for what you don't know is the big push from Amazon.
Jeez.
It's pretty insulting. And you could just sort of scroll down. It goes on for a while. Really goofy website, I have to say, for one of the wealthiest companies in the world.
Be a doer, not a doer. Damn, man.
Somebody also pointed out to me that it's very clearly a Squarespace.
Yeah, oh, 100%. This is a Squarespace scroll.
they care enough to try to union bust, but they don't care enough to make a more compelling website than this.
Don't buy that dinner. Don't buy those school supplies. Don't buy those gifts because you won't have that almost $500 you paid in dues. Why not save the money and get the books, gifts, and things you want? Because we know what you want. Books, gifts, and things.
Actually, if you go up to the top, real quickly, it just goes on forever. It's the same old nonsense. I'm sorry. The first big wall text that they have, ABHM1, doers, why pay almost $500 in dues? We've got you covered.
Asterisk.
And they put in very tiny letters in a completely unreadable font, if you could just highlight that, applies to regular full-time employees. Which, again, is one of those great problems of people who work in that kind of industry, is that they love to schedule just under.
Enhance.
Being a full-time. Yeah, you have to enhance to be able to see the asterisk, which is the reason why people are trying to form a union, because so that they can make sure that everybody is getting those benefits and is also making sure that everybody, that nobody is getting artificially cut off to prevent them from getting the benefits that Amazon is advertising. If you go back, Matt, there's the other website that was put together. It's not on my tweet. It's in the show notes. Oh. But our friends, at the good folks at, what is it? The tech workers at a, hold on, y'all, sorry about that. The Tech Workers Coalition, which is a coalition of workers in and around the tech industry, labor organizers, community organizers, and friends, who do great advocacy. They put together a phenomenal parody website called Do It With Real Power. If you go down to the very bottom, Matt, sorry, the second tweet. Yeah. Do It With Real Power. Hey, BHM1 workers, why join a union? Because Amazon has never had you covered. In the asterisk, they put no caveats. basically, for people who are living, they created almost one-to-one copy, but with factual information here. Amazon's leadership has kept you from the high wages, healthcare, vision, and dental benefits, as well as a safety committee and an appeals process that you deserve. There's so much more you can do for your career and your family in solidarity with fellow workers. Unions pay. Know the facts. An authorization card or online form is a sign of solidarity and the first step to higher wages and benefits. Workers do not pay union dues until your union has won a contract, and winning a contract can mean warehouse conditions, protections from arbitrary disciplines and firings, salary increases, and proper grievance protocols. Be a worker with rights. If you join a union, it will be a transformative meaning. It will be easier to be as helpful. Well, I want to see what they say about unions mean more. On average, unionized workers earn 19% more than non-unionized workers. So if you make the average $31,000 a year, a union could win you an increase in your paycheck of $5,900 annually. That's a whole lot more dinners, school supplies, gifts, and dignity. I love it. I think that's such a good.
I mean, I think it's just amazing how one of the great internet companies of our time does the shitty Squarespace scroll, yeah, and can be topped. Just like the copy, be a doer. My boss calls me a doer, man, and in the process of telling me not to join a union. That's
dark, man.
That's bad.
I mean, they think we're all idiots, and we should come at them strong for that, because it's not just evil, it's just really insulting. I found that whole website to be.
Yeah.
All right, y'all. So we have this interview that we did with Milton Alamani, going over the events in Uganda. For folks who might not be familiar, Bobby Wine, who ran against Museveni, who has been in power for 35 years. Wine has been under house arrest, essentially, since the election. There's a lot of reason to believe that that election process was extremely rigged. Even without proving any kind of like fraud on the election itself, Bobby Wine has faced immense violence from the police and the military throughout this campaign. In no way, shape, or form can you consider this election to have been legitimate. Milton Alamani is going to spend a lot of time breaking down why. We recorded it on Tuesday. So the second half where we sort of talk a little bit about Joe Biden and the January 6th protests. That's why it might seem like we're talking in the future there.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks, here we go. And David, you want to mute yourself.
Cool. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Left Reckoning. Matt and I are joined by our friend, Milton Alamadi, the founder of Black Star News, also the host of the African History Club, which you can find on Patreon, which is a must subscribe. How are you doing today, Milton?
Very good. Good to see you, man. Good to see both of you.
No, it really is. It really is such a treat. It's too bad the subject matter we have today isn't too light. I think, you know, no reason to really dance around it. What's going on in Uganda, especially for the past few months, but particularly in this past week, has been quite striking with Museveni, who's been the leader for, what, about 35 years?
Yes.
Claiming victory again in this election, claiming 59% of the vote, while his main opponent, Bobby Wine, is saying that, one, there's election fraud, and two, has been holed up in his house, I believe, you know, surrounded by military and police.
That's right.
What's the kind of situation right now? What's it looking like there?
Okay, well, it's kind of explosive because, as you said, he is surrounded by about 500 soldiers. But it also tells you something. If one individual and his wife, those are the only two people, as far as I know, in the home, surrounded by 500 soldiers with a helicopter that flies overhead every 30 minutes, with a drone that comes and hovers overhead for a little bit. So I think clearly, this show of overwhelming strength is not really being targeted at Bobby Wine. You don't need 500 soldiers to confine one individual and his wife in their home. He's sending the signal. The Museveni, as you pointed out, he's been around for 35 years. Being a brutal dictator, this typical neocolonial regime in Africa. He's sending a signal to supporters of Bobby Wine, but not only supporters of Bobby Wine. But after 35 years, you can imagine that people want change. He's sending a signal to all those that would perhaps consider starting a civil protest to get rid of him, that this is what will meet you. If I can do this in the capital city of Kampala, with all the media from all over the world witnessing this, you know, imagine what I will do to you in the other parts of the country where you don't have all these cameras, right? Mm-hmm. So now the guy is running out of food, right? And the U.S. ambassador to Uganda. And the U.S. is a big culprit here because the U.S. has sustained this guy with U.S. taxpayers' money, $1 billion every year. And I'll get to explain that in a little bit. But the ambassador, her name is Natalie Brown, tried to go and see Bobby Wine because I get the sense that the U.S. has had enough. And they can see the writing on the wall, too, that the young people really want this guy out now. So she tried to go see him at his home yesterday, and she was blocked by the Ugandan soldiers from going. And people are saying this is very significant, because really without the U.S., this guy would not be able to survive. They not only provide him all that money, but they also provide him the military equipment. They also train his army. And his son was also trained here at Fort Leavenworth, the military academy there, you know, grooming the next dictator in Uganda, of course. But it looks like that scheme is not going to happen. And I think so now he's I think he's actually losing it a bit. He used to be a little better in terms of dealing with Uganda and dealing with the U.S. at the same time. But I think he's panicked. He's realized that in his scheme of things, after prolonging his regime, he had never imagined that a person like Bobby Wine would come out. So what did he do? He's stolen the last five elections or so. This is the sixth one. And in every case, he would deploy massively on the streets and supporters of the opposition candidate. In the last four elections, it had been a guy named Dr. Kizza Besigye, a retired military officer and a retired medical doctor. And he has supporters, but most of his supporters are like working class folks. So they can only come out to the streets for a while. And then after a while, you know, things die down. They go back to their 9-to-5s. Now, in this case, it's a bit different. You find a guy who's 38. The country, the population is 80% under the age of 35. So what he did is he did a voter drive, massive voter drive, and got them to register in the millions throughout the country. So he changed the voting roll completely overnight. And essentially, that is why he won. They voted for him. Nobody in Uganda believes the dictator won. And the way the U.S. is now sort of distancing itself from him, it seems clear that the U.S. also know that he clearly lost this election. So I think that's the kind of summary I can give you.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you, you know, a couple things and also frame this for folks, too, because it's not just the reaction after the election. Bobi Wine throughout this campaign has been targeted by the military and the
police.
And also in 2019, they implemented a social media tax.
Yes.
To basically prevent people from being able to interact online. Absolutely. And after this election as well, shut down the internet. Could you sort of categorize or explain to folks who might not have been following what's been happening during the campaign itself?
Of course. Thank you for those questions. Because as you and I know, it is only in Uganda that this would be actually described as quote unquote election. Yes, completely preposterous. Let's talk about the immediate violence that accompanied the campaign. So the guy was kind of slick in the beginning, the dictator Museveni. He said, oh, due to the coronavirus, it's not safe to hold regular elections. So everything, the campaign is going to be done electronically. But I think he then went back and thought about it and thought, wait, this might actually hurt me. So he said, no, yeah, you can have people show up, but no more than 200 people. So he starts campaigning. And of course, you know, a lot more than 200 people show up at his rallies. But then when he sees Bobi Wine's rallies, where tens of thousands of people are actually showing up, you know, whole communities, then he panics. And that's when the armed forces starts attacking Bobi Wine and his supporters physically. And the worst incident was on November 18, when Bobi Wine was arrested and there was a protest all over the country. And the soldiers started opening live round fire on demonstrators. And the government itself admits that 54 people were killed. And people in Uganda believe that when that is the official count, the number could be four or five times, even more than that. And about 600 people are arrested and they're still in jail, you know, in prisons. And these are supporters of Bobi Wine as well. And worst of all, they started targeting journalists as well. Some journalists were expelled from the country, but the journalists who accompanied Bobi Wine on his rallies, they were beaten or shot at. So then all the journalists got together and they demanded an explanation from the police chief. Why is this going on? And the police chief, and this was infamously said, and this was widely reported. His name is Martin Okoth Ochola, and I want people to know this name. Because this is the kind of guy who needs to be brought up in front of the ICC. I know the ICC has all its problems, but still, there's some people that deserve to be indicted anyway. And this is one such person. He said, these journalists are being beaten for their own good, for their own protection, because they tend to go into places that are not safe. So when we beat them, we're actually dissuading them. And therefore, we're helping to save their lives. And he said this in an official press conference, and it was reported by Reuters, and it ran in many publications around the world. One actually was shot and severely injured on the head, one of the reporters. And you notice that it was only the journalists covering Bobi Wine who were being assaulted. All those trailing the dictator himself, nobody was harmed. And then in terms of the internet itself was shut down totally 2 days before the election. So the country went for about 5 days with a total 100% internet blackout. And as you also noted, yes, they imposed this this tax last year. And obviously it's also to incapacitate the young people who are, they're 80% of the population, but also 80% unemployed. So even though it may sound like just a few dollars, it's a lot of money in a country like Uganda. Here's one interesting point, though. The internet, the primary reason why it was shut down was obviously to prevent people from communicating the results as they were coming out. Because what Bobby Wine supporters did was to develop an application, and the app is called YouVote. And it would allow people to, because after they vote at the polling stations, all the candidates' agents sign off on the form with the total vote count per polling station. So what Bobby Wine supporters or voters did, they would take an image of it on their cell phone, and then they would transmit it to the app. Now, by shutting down the internet, that process was disrupted. But in shutting down the internet, the process affected everybody, whether you were opposition or whether you're the regime. So the question is, how was the regime able to obtain the figures from where they got the 59% that the dictator was awarded? So when a reporter from Al Jazeera asked this question, the election commissioner, who, by the way, is handpicked by the dictator himself, had no answer, could not respond, mumbled, and then said, oh, we had our own way of doing it. And their own way, of course, is basically just cooking up the numbers.
You mentioned earlier the $1 billion in aid that the U.S. gives Museveni. What's the prognosis for him with the U.S. losing patience?
I think it's not a good sign, really, to be honest with you. And that is the dilemma of the neo-colonial dictator in an African country. And if we look at the case of Mobutu in the Congo, which he had changed into Zaire, he would run the country for 37 years. People that know the history of the Congo may recall that once Congo won its independence from Belgium, Patrice Lumumba, this Pan-African nationalist prime minister, was murdered brutally, and involving the CIA and Belgian intelligence and Belgian military, because they saw a person that would challenge the control over Congo. It's one of the richest countries mineral-wise in the world, has uranium, which at that time, of course, was big, important for the West. It still is. And it has everything else. You name it. Diamond, cobalt, gold, you name it. Congo has that. So that's why Patrice Lumumba was brutally murdered. And Mobutu, he fits perfectly the caricature of the typical neocolonial dictator in Africa, who uses the public treasury as his personal possession. He tramples on the population, kills, massacres, locks up opposition, but he's fine so long as he's tight with the West, in this case, the United States. So they maintain him for till 1997. But then when the U.S. saw the writing on the wall that this guy is completely unpopular now, they saw the signs of change is about to come, they started backing off from him. And now we see the kind of similar statements that the U.S. Started making about Mobutu. They're now making about Museveni. For the first time, this is the U.S. for the first time saying that the election was fundamentally flawed. That's a very serious repudiation, really. You know, you're essentially saying we can't work with you anymore. And I think that's how he's reading it too. And that's how why he's becoming much more repressive. And why does the U.S. give Museveni $1 billion? And now he's still able to get away with the brutality historically. Because Somalia is one of the most unstable countries in Africa. And there's a militia there called Al-Shabaab. And it was growing in strength. And the U.S. feared that Al-Shabaab, which has a relationship with Al-Qaeda, and this is what the U.S. tells us, after if it were to gain power in Somalia, would turn it sort of like how Afghanistan was when the Taliban was in power, and then, you know, make this as a country where they could plot against U.S. interests or even U.S. targets, right? And so Uganda, essentially as Museveni rather, not Uganda, has rented Uganda's army to police Somalia. So he's deployed like 10,000 soldiers there for the last 12 years. And every time the U.S. raises the issue of human rights, he's like, well, I could always withdraw from Somalia, right? So that is the contract with the devil, sort of to speak. That's the relationship between Museveni and the United States. And sadly, for the people of Somalia, and there's a reason why the conflict in Somalia lasts for 12 years, Museveni has no interest in having that conflict resolved, because then he would not have that. He couldn't come back to the U.S. and blackmail the U.S. anymore, because there would be nothing over which to blackmail the U.S., and that nefarious relationship would have to end. So what does he do? He, and this people can even look it up, his own soldiers sell weapons to the same Al-Shabaab that they're supposed to be fighting against. And obviously it makes sense if you don't want the conflict to ever end.
So I wanted to ask, I know it's hard to sit here and know what's going to happen next, but to sort of set that up, to sort of look at the future. One, it was noted that Bobi Wine's party did pick up seats in parliament, but it's still something like 56 or 60 seats to 300 yes. of the ruling party.
Yes.
You know, so it's an opposition, but it's quite small in general. And then in addition to that, I would be curious when it comes to the military. I mean, that's also very much connected to Museveni and, right. and that party, right? The military is not at all seeing any kind of fracture.
Well, that's a very good idea. I'm glad you asked that question, actually. Let me tackle the military first part. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of young officers who have, fled the country, and a few have been calling me and actually telling me how so many in the military actually are against the dictator, and they also actually want to see change, that enough is enough. And these are the people that I've spoken with are people that are in their 30s as well. So they're of Bobi Wine's generation, and they relate to him. And Museveni, of course, in 76, belongs to a totally different generation. So, yeah, that's a very good question. I never would have even brought it up had you not mentioned it. But, yes, I know the military is not cohesive. And, in fact, when he deployed massively in Kampala, the capital city, right before the election, people in Kampala were saying that many of the soldiers did not seem to be Ugandans, and that they may have been brought from South Sudan. South Sudan is Museveni. Like Museveni is a client state of Washington. South Sudan is a client state of Museveni, because in the domestic conflict there between the President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar, Museveni had intervened on Salva Kiir's side. So Salva Kiir is basically just returning the favor by helping deploy. So why would you deploy South Sudanese instead of Ugandan soldiers? You would do that because you're not confident about the loyalty of the Ugandan soldiers, that they would commit atrocities. So, for example, if we had like a civil uprising, Ugandans don't believe that Ugandan soldiers would start shooting en masse and kill hundreds or maybe even thousands of Ugandans. So that answers that part of the question. And in terms of the 60%, the 60 seats or so, that itself is evidence to most Ugandans that Bobi Wine not only won the election, but probably the 60 seats is a massive undercount. If you could win officially 60, given all the intimidation, given the assaults, the brutality, the physical beating of opposition candidates, that number should actually be higher. So now even people that have long experience in Ugandan politics are reading between the lines, and they know that, you know, something is probably going to change sooner rather than later in Uganda. And the interesting thing is that they're now beginning to get information through YouVote, that app. And so far, and theirs is based on the signed declaration forms that are sent in. And they have a tallying center, which is outside the country. And they've gotten polling results from 4,095 out of a total of 34,714 polling stations around the country. And in their tally, Bobi Wine is actually leading 72.7% to Museveni's 24.5%. And that number is actually not shocking if you map it against the population of Uganda, and then you map it against the new people that Bobi Wine was able to sign on as voters.
Well, I want to kind of move back domestic, Milton. I think, you know, the Trump administration, we're pre-recording this a little bit, so we're near the end of that. I wanted to get your perspective on the Capitol 6 riots or insurrection or however you would define that, and just what commentary you think is necessary about that.
Well, it's very interesting, but it was inevitable, given that, you know, you really had a raging dictator, you know, in the White House. He was only confined to the extent that he could not do a lot of the things that he would be able to get away with in a country like Uganda, of course. Otherwise, this guy has shown the tendency that he would be happy to deploy the military. And he made several attempts, did he not? You know, and many of the comments that he made consistently. So I was not surprised that something like that would really happen. And if you follow what he was saying all along, the buildup to that, it was not that shocking. He was just a bit desperate, trying every measure, calling up the Secretary of State in Georgia. That was phenomenal. That was actually a person who, if you imagine, change that to he's not talking to a Secretary of State. Imagine if he had found five reckless generals who were in a conversation with him like that. You know, what would they be talking about? Of course, they would be talking about occupying the Capitol and other significant monumental buildings in Washington, D.C., and actually launching an actual coup d'etat. And who's to know? I would not be shocked if at some point we learn that he actually had these type of conversations with some generals, or maybe Michael Flynn was his conduit, having these types of conversations. And you've read bits and pieces here and there to suggest that, yes, Michael Flynn might have been having that kind of conversation. So the fact that he was not able to launch an actual military coup did not prevent him from trying to do it in a different way. So when he spoke to the Secretary of State, and first of all, obviously the guy is a bit unhinged. Let's say he had managed to succeed in Georgia, you know, alone, right? And change the outcome there. So what? That would not have changed the outcome of the election, right? So, but then what is the best second thing that he could do as opposed to an outright military coup? Call all these folks that, as he said, the kind of folks that would still follow him, even if he shot somebody on Fifth Avenue, right? They would still vote for him. He said that, remember? So he knows their mindset. He knew exactly what he was doing when he made those statements, particularly when he said, I will be marching with you or behind you, something like that. And then if you combine that with what Giuliani was saying and all the other speakers, it was inevitable that that was going to happen. And then you have the guy intimidating his own vice president. I don't know what he wanted Pence to really do. Telling Pence that you can actually do something which Pence and everybody knows he can't do. But it just imagine. So now, instead of sending soldiers, he sends these Trump nuts into the Capitol to physically intimidate the people certifying this election. To do what? I don't understand. To throw up the counts that came in through the state and just add up the ones they wanted to add up and declare him president? I don't get it. But he was clearly trying to launch a coup d'etat and to remain as president of the United States. Is it shocking? It's shocking in the sense that this is happening in the United States. But at the same time, it's not shocking when you see the individual who is president of the United States at this time. But it's obviously very dangerous, because even after something this blatant, you still have Republicans coming there. Instead of all of them now saying, we have now realized the danger of really promoting this demagogue and going along with him, and now it came to our very doorsteps, trying to, what if those Trump nuts had actually managed to break into the chambers, would they have started saying, oh, let me identify, they weren't holding pictures, and said, let me identify who's a Democrat and maybe kill those? You know, think about that. So that could have happened. It didn't happen that way, but people did die. But they found out about this later. They knew when they came back to vote on certification later on that it had been a close call. And yet you still have all these Republicans still talking about a stolen election. Wow. That really tells you how dangerous things are in this country. And that this thing that we saw in the Capitol perhaps is not the last of what we'll see. Maybe not in the Capitol itself, but it could be other targets, including the Capitol itself again. And that's where the United States has arrived at.
Yeah. What do you think the response should be? Because there's a lot of concern that there will be just a doubling down of war on terror sort of remedies, and that that might lead to, you know, surveillance and things like that. What do you think as far as like the response goes?
That is the danger, really, to be honest with you. To pretend that I know what would be the adequate response, I have no idea. I'll be very frank with you. If you have a guy who now has found the art of holding people that might be a little more level-headed in better circumstances, now know that he can easily click people to mobilize against you if you're elected representative, whether in the Senate or in Congress, and you're going to be out. So you have to identify with the most radical elements. They're not going to go away. It's not where, like, he was less radical in a crazy sense, not progressive radical, right? I'm talking about Trump. At the minute that the assault, the insurrection occurred on the Capitol, he had demonstrated how nutty and how reckless he was, really, to any extremes all along. And yet he still got, 74 million votes? Just think about that. So I think he's sort of drawn a line that there's a very substantial part of this country that are willing to risk it all. I don't know. On the other hand, we might be overreading it in a way too. There could be many who also, fundamentally opposed and afraid of how this country is changing, the demographics, right? And those respond to some of those, the dog whistle, and in this case, very explicit, actually, you know, let's take our country back, you know, let's protect our civilization, you know, make America strong, and all that kind of stuff. And they may actually like this, as, you know, we still really matter. Somebody's talking to us and saying, you know, we just don't have to surrender to the change that's coming. Can they be like that and not support the kind of assault, the reckless assault of the Capitol? Maybe that was going over the line for a substantial part of that population. I still don't know. So those are the kind of stories we need to explore further, do more research, more polling into. And I suspect at the end of the day that there are more people that think it's worth preserving stability in this country with whatever all the woes that this country has. I don't think a substantial majority, I don't think even close to a majority, are as reckless as Donald Trump. I think there is a huge, almost perhaps majority, as the votes indicate, who are willing to always scapegoat somebody else for their problems. And that Trump made it okay to scapegoat others without fear of being called that, you know, you're racist, although if Trump is your representing this for you, I don't see how you cannot be seen as a racist, seeing that he does not hide that aspect. I think what I'm trying to say is that I think there are millions of people who go along with Trumpism, but to a certain extent. And maybe those were not the ones represented in terms of the people that raided and entered the Capitol, because we did see images of some of those, and just based on the ranting, the conversations they were having, it seemed like they would not reflect the majority of even people that opposed progressive politics or even democratic politics in this country. So that gives me a little hope, you know? I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, well, I think as evidence, Biden did beat Trump in an election. And,
yes.
You know, right? So what are the top, you know, what are you keeping an eye on with regards to the Biden administration? Let's put Trump in the rear view, you know, hopefully tomorrow. What do you look at? What are you going to be watching closely?
I think at this stage, I'm willing to say when it comes to many of the domestic issues, anybody but Trump is an improvement. So I'll give him that. Obviously, he's not progressive. He's, was trying to tight rope around universal health coverage, for example. And then ultimately, of course, repudiated it. Said, oh, no, that's not my plan. So, you know, the same thing when we talk about the Green Revolution. So I think the only thing I can say is that it was about time Trump left the White House. I can't say too much for Biden, but I can say this, though, that at least when it comes to foreign policy, he's indicated that human rights is going to be a big part of his foreign policy, which, of course, would rule out supporting a person like the Ugandan dictator, General Museveni. And we have other people like Museveni in other African countries, like in Cameroon. There's also a guy who's been there maybe 40 years, actually, basically sustained by the U.S. and by France, because it's an oil-rich country. And basically the same thing, neglects the population. But so long as he appeases his Western benefactors, it's fine. So that's where I could see some substantial change. But in terms of the kind of progressive, more radical type politics that I think a growing part of the U.S. Population is actually now sympathetic toward, of course, you know, he's not going to deliver any of that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that
right.
if that's a sufficient answer.
No, that's great. I mean, we had Daniel Bessner on last week, and you know, one of the big questions he was asking himself about the Biden administration, and he's leaning, you know, one way on this, is whether or not Biden is going to be a kind of like sit back and let the apparatus run itself, kind of president, or if he's going to be involved. And you know, it's looking like he's probably going to be passing the reins over to folks like Samantha Power and people like that. So,
yes,
you know, there's definitely going to be a lot to watch over the next, especially early on, to see what kind of policy we're going to see developed out of the Biden administration there.
Yes. And I might want to add in terms of, you know, people like Samantha Power as well. People like, you know, Susan Rice. And even people like the UN ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield. Now, these were, of course, people who were in the Obama administration as well. And as people that follow events in Africa closely know, they were, you know, key players in the laissez-faire, let things be attitude toward Museveni, let things be toward Kabila in the Congo and toward Kagame in Rwanda. But I think it's going to be very difficult to reverse the trend of what is happening. Whether the U.S. likes it or not, things have really changed dramatically on the ground in Africa. The young population really are in the forefront now because they saw what young people could do in the Sudan. Mm-hmm. When you had Omar Bashir, a military dictator, been there for 30 years. But when young people said enough is enough, you know, they came out on the streets. Even young women came out as well. And many people saw that because they were live streaming a lot of the protests on their phones. So we got to see that around the world. And ultimately, even though the guy hit back brutally, I think more than 100 were shot at one point. And they didn't go away. After the smoke cleared, they were back on the streets. Ultimately, they got rid of Bashir. I mean, the military saw the writing on the wall, so they eased him out, and they came into sort of a power-sharing arrangement so that the military could use some time frame to ease themselves out of the political equation in the Sudan. So people, the young people in Uganda have seen this. Young people in Congo saw that. And that's why even if the U.S. had any type of an agenda to reverse back to the old school, it's not going to be possible in Africa. And I think just reading by what's happening, I know there's already at least the conversation that I'm hearing that there was some informal conversations between the incoming foreign policy team and the folks that are still in the State Department, at least until tomorrow. And the signals were consistent. The incoming folks were also sending the same type of signal to Museveni that enough is enough, and there's going to be a new type of relationship with the United States going forward. So that's why even though some of these names that people were like, you know, very concerned about from the past are still on the team, the new team, things have also changed dramatically on the ground to be able to go back.
That makes sense to me. Umet, did you have anything else? Or
no, I think that's a good way. We kind of came full circle.
I think that's a perfect way. We'll definitely have to recap this soon as we see what happens over the next couple of weeks in Uganda. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you, Milton.
Signal,
I guess. You know, people definitely check out Black Star News and African History Club. Thank you so much. It's such a treat to see you.
And don't forget at Ali Mahdi on Twitter.
Yes, absolutely.
At Ali Mahdi, yeah.
It's a good follow.
All right, folks, keep up the good work, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Stay strong.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Peace and blessings.
All right. Yeah, the great Milton Ali Mahdi there. You know, an interesting thing. I mean, I think that's a good point about the Museveni thing is like you have a whole bunch of people who were there and plenty happy to look the other way, but things on the ground change, and that's where you might see changes in policy.
Yeah, and it also should be noted that since we recorded this interview, the European Union and the United States have, you know, made pretty bold statements against the house arrests of
Mr.
Bobby
President.
Wine.
Can you unite the country?
From that, whatever you will.
Sorry about that. The video of the guy asking Biden to unite the country was playing a little bit over top of you, but I think they heard. I'm trying to find our little outro. So we have that ready. We're going to play it. But we have one more story we want to talk about before we...
I just wanted to highlight this for folks who might not be familiar. There's another strike to show solidarity with at the Hunts Point Produce Market in the Bronx, which honestly is one of the main reasons that people in New York City are able to enjoy fresh produce at all. It's one of the major distribution hubs for grocery stores across the area. But 1,400 warehouse workers and drivers of the Teamsters Local 202 have been on strike since Saturday after negotiations over a $1 an hour raise fell apart. $1 an hour for these essential workers who are feeding the largest city in the United States during a pandemic. It also has to be mentioned that Hunts Point Market got a $15 million PPP loan, but they're refusing to pay the increase in wages of these workers. Again, $1 an hour. Rather, they offered them a measly 33 cents, which is a joke. So there has been an ongoing strike since Saturday, 24 hours, which has been pretty incredible. And a lot of different people have showed up. But first, Matt, do you have these pieces of sound prepped?
Yeah, I got the Teamsters talking about the truck being turned back and the AOC.
Yeah, so we have the first one here. This, I believe, was on MLK Day, where they ended up actually arresting six.
Sorry about that. I had a different one, but I can get that ready too.
Yeah.
The arrest. Yep, got that.
Yeah, it's the first one.
Okay.
So workers there were, as the police, which I think was almost like a 3-to-1 police to protesters. They shouted, "Hands up, don't shoot." Yeah, that's good. I mean, just another reminder of the role.
Disorderly conduct. This is the New York City
police. Here's the cops actually storming them.
You are unlawfully in the roadway and obstructing vehicular traffic.
And you can hear, like, that, what you hear, that megaphone, that's not there for the people there, really. That's there for anybody filming that the police get their message blaring over the top of it.
And charged with disorderly conduct.
And it's just absolutely disgusting. Another reminder of the police's role in this country and across the world in general, which is to be the armed guard and the armed force defending the interests of capital. Again, remember, these workers are fighting for an extra dollar an hour during a massive pandemic after the company they work for received a significant PPP loan. They're out there trying to fight for just basic decency and respect and fair pay for their work. And the police break that up in the most disgusting fashion. The second clip I wanted to share with everybody, because, you know, on this show, we think it's really important to be critical while also, you know, supportive as we can of people who we are putting into to power to represent us. And, you know, AOC is somebody who we criticize a fair amount on this show. Talk about some of the actions that she's taken that we disagree with, particularly just some kind of, you know, mistakes, for example, when she was taking pictures with Bolivian fascists in Congress while Evo was fighting for his life against a right-wing fascist coup. Like, we will come at AOC for that kind of stuff. But I also think it's important to remember why having somebody like AOC in Congress and also able to articulate these kind of politics is really important, because there have been a lot of politicians who have showed up at this strike because people recognize that this is an important moment. But a lot of politicians aren't going to be talking the way that AOC is going to be talking, like in this clip. And I think that is a very good thing and something we should be supportive of.
Demanding an end to poverty, demanding an end to war, demanding a better material and just outcomes. For all people in the United States, this is why I do what I do. And I just want you to know too that you're not just standing up for that baby, you're standing up for babies all across this country.
That's right.
Because just like there are workers here, there are workers, food workers in every pocket of the United States who deserve more than a dollar. Who deserve more than a raise. They deserve health care. They deserve justice. They deserve good working worker rights. And that's what we're here to fight for today. So I want you all to know that when you're standing on this line, you're not just asking for a dollar. You are asking for transformational change for your lives and for the lives of every food worker across this country, for kids of food workers across this country. Because there's a lot of things upside down right now in our economy. And one of those things that are upside down is the fact that a person who is helping get the food to your table cannot feed their own kids. That's upside down.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I love connecting that to war. I like connecting that to workers across the country. I think building that kind of consciousness, that's important work. So I was really happy to see that. And solidarity to, you know, the Teamsters in their fight for a fair wage, man. It's a good thing to see people rising up.
Absolutely. I think is that all we have to go?
No, that's it. I was just going to say, you know, for patrons, we'll be jumping on the post game pretty soon. So look for that link on Patreon. Great time to sign up if you're not already a patron. We'll be taking some Discord questions, a little preview of the 1776 report, which I'm sure will change a lot of hearts and minds.
Yeah, it's a big win for patriotism.
Tim Pool in another edition of How to Miss the Point. maybe some base Jake Tapper.
Jake Tapper stumbling into saying something you would not expect Jake Tapper to say. and stumbling may not be the right term there, but anyways. to play us out, as Bill O'Reilly would put it, we have the Chris Brune country song theme that we have, and it's I combined it with a video made by Vice, where they did a compilation of Trump saying bye bye, and I don't know if we'll keep this for very long, but it thematically it works as an outro. So
it's very fun.
Everybody enjoy this, and for patrons, we'll see you probably in 20-25 minutes back here at YouTube. So check your feeds for that. So David, we'll see you in a little bit.
So I'm gonna leave now. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye bye. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
I'm out of here. Bye.
Bye bye.
Okay.
Bye bye.
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 Bye.
Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it. Bye bye.
Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Well, have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
Bing bing.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye to Iowa.
Bye bye.
And to other places.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye folks.
Bye bye folks.
That's it. Bye bye. Wave goodbye.
Bye bye.
Bye everybody.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Bye 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 bye.
See you sometime.
Bye bye.
Good luck.
Bye bye.
Have fun.
Bye bye. We're leaving. Bye.
Enjoy yourself.
Bye bye.
Enjoy yourself.
We're leaving. Bye.
Bye bye.
Gotta get on the plane.
Bye bye.
Bye bye, darling.
Bye bye, Frank. You're a wonderful guy.
Bye everybody.
I can go home now. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye bye. I'm going. I'll go to Turnberry. I'll go someplace and I'll enjoy my life, and that's the end of that.
Bye bye.
We're finished.
Goodbye, everybody, and that's the end. And everyone says, oh, that was fun.